Jerry mentioned Sandra Postel's talk last night. If anybody didn't hear it, I really recommend you go see it. It was an extremely good talk on the global situation on water. Sandra's very well known in that field. I'm delighted to be here to talk about the connection between water and energy. I'm a physicist by training. I'm not an agronomist. And I'm enjoying being here because I'm learning a lot about soils. I am concerned about climate change and carbon and stuff like that. And what I'm learning is the answer is going to be in the soils, whether it's water, carbon emissions, and stuff like that. So I've been sort of expanding my own horizons as I've attended this meeting. Let's see. What I'm going to talk about very briefly, looks like a lot of stuff, why I'm here, how I, as a physicist, I'm a low-temperature solid-state physicist by training. So, I mean, it's a legitimate question to ask. How did I get into this whole water business? And I'll try to explain that. I'm going to talk about the conflict between water goals and energy goals. Give you a little bit of context on both water and energy. You know the water stuff. You may not know all the energy stuff. And Sandra did a good job last night of presenting the water context. I want to talk about the linkages between water and energy so you understand how closely associated the two quantities are. And then how do you address the conflict, the conundrum between wanting more water, clean water, and more energy. And of course, in this day and age, it's hard to avoid saying something about fracking. So I'll say something very briefly, and if you want to pursue that topic, I'll be glad to answer questions later. I've identified a few things that I think our communities need to do to get a better handle on the relationship between water and energy, and then a few final thoughts. My purpose is very simple. I just want to point out the very close relationship between water and energy issues, what has come to be widely known as the water-energy nexus. Of course, nexus is a word that means connections, and if you really want to think about it as broadly as you can, there's a nexus among water, energy, food, health, and environment. And what happens, of course, is people get overwhelmed by the immensity of the connections, and so they specialize in, like I have, in water and energy, and other people do it on water and food, but they're all connected in some significant way. How did I get to this point of talking about water? Of course, my field is in energy, was really renewable energy, solar, wind, biomass, geothermal, and all the other good stuff that the world is going to enjoy long after we're all gone. And you think about water in limited ways, because when you use, let's say, wind energy or photovoltaics, solar energy of that type, you don't need water. And so you can, if you can substitute those energy sources for a fossil fuel plant or a nuclear plant, you can reduce the water demand tremendously. And, you know, we all do think about that. But, you know, it wasn't a big thing in my life. And then my life actually got changed at the end of the Clinton administration, the first Clinton administration. when I was invited to go to the Middle East to attend a water planning conference in the Middle East. As you may remember, the water issue was a big part of the peace process between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And someday a guy showed up in front of me and he said, "We'd like you to go to Amman, Jordan, and represent our department in planning for this water conference among Arafat, the head of the PA, Barak, the head of the Israeli government, and King Hussein of Jordan. I said, why me? I don't know a damn thing about water, except what I read in the papers. And their reason was my expertise in renewables, which they knew would be part of the answer. I had also done a lot of work with senior officials in other governments as part of my renewable energy work. So anyway, they gave me some reasons for me to go, and I said yes, and put myself on a fast learning curve, and I went to Amman a month later. And at the meeting, there were about 50 people, mostly water experts from Jordan, Israel, and the PA. And they all knew each other because they've been working together for years. And a few of us Americans sprinkled in. I had two colleagues from Lawrence Livermore who were hydrologists, and myself with the energy perspective, and there was a guy from the State Department who was bringing the political perspective in. And I got hooked. And I really got hooked when the head of the PA Water Authority, a guy named Nabil al-Sharif, stood up, and he was, by the way, a civil engineer who was a classmate of Arafat's, who was a civil engineer. And he just got up and said, there will be no peace in the Middle East until you solve the water problem. You know, that sort of brought it home for me. So when I came back to the States, I said, I'm going to learn more about this stuff. And for the next, well, almost a decade and a half, I've been doing water energy work. The conflict between the goals is very simple. As the world increases its population and people want increased material comforts, they're going to want more energy and they're going to want more water. And there's an inherent conflict between the two because energy is a clear contributor to the global climate change process that we have in the world today. Unless you can switch over to some other sources. And so you just have a natural conflict built in. And I use the word conundrum because I vowed to myself many years ago that one time before I pass on, I'm going to use the word conundrum in a paper. And I wrote a paper with the word conundrum in it. It's a nice word. I like it. But anyway, that's the conflict. That you want more clean water, you want more energy, and sometimes the two don't fit together. And so there's always going to be trade-offs, as there is in everything in life. And that's what we have to address. The water context, I don't want to say much about this because you guys know it better than I do, but there is an Arab saying, water is life. That's an absolute truism. If you don't have water, you die. There are no substitutes for water. There's nothing that replaces water in our lives. I think it is the most valuable commodity on Earth. The conflict over water has shaped human history in all kinds of ways. The Earth is a water-rich planet. And the number is there, it's a staggering amount. And we've had this water as long as there's been life on this planet, and maybe long before that. And it doesn't change, it just gets recycled. And the water you're drinking today is the same water that went through a dinosaur 100 million years ago. You know, we're not running out of water. So why is there a problem? And the answer is obviously known. Now, it's interesting. See, the number I use is 96% is in the oceans. I noticed that Sandra and Jerry just used 97.5. Doesn't change the conclusion. Most of our water is in the oceans. It's salty, 35,000 parts per million on average. And drinking water is 1,000 parts per million or less. And if you drink salt water, it kills you eventually because your body just dehydrates and your kidneys fail and you're gone. most of the water, the fresh water, is not available for our use. It's tied up in ice caps and glaciers, which I have to point out is a receding problem now that the world has figured out how to melt the ice caps and the glaciers. There's some water vapor in the atmosphere at all times. And, you know, there's not a lot in our groundwater and lakes and rivers, so the net result is that we use a lot less than 1% of our water for all of our needs. That's just the context for water use in our planet. The energy context is a little different. I would point out that there's no substitute for water. There are substitutes for energy. That's a very important difference between the two. In many ways, the two are the most basic things we need to function. But in water, there's no choice. With energy, you can choose a different energy source if you want. Today's societies use electricity and other energy-dependent services to a high extent. Energy has always been important. But in the old days, animal power, some human power sufficed. But today, with all the services we have, and communication, and lighting, and so on, you need a lot of energy. And electrification was a big thing in the 20th century, and it's continuing into the 21st century. We're going to electrify our transportation fleets to a significant extent. That's happening right now. You know, projections all say the same thing. Energy demand is going to grow up, or go up, particularly in developing countries as they begin to develop further from where they are. And emissions will grow because a lot of these places will use coal, natural gas, and oil. Hopefully we can turn that situation around over the next several decades, but it ain't going to happen tomorrow. And my field of renewables, which I will talk about all week long if you let me, is happening. I'm delighted that I've lived long enough to see the revolution beginning. I didn't expect to when I was younger. But it's not going to happen overnight either. It's going to take time. Major energy transitions do take time, takes money, takes planning. And so we're going to be using fossil fuels for a while. The linkages are pretty clear. You need energy to extract water from underground aquifers. You've got to pump it up. You're going to push water through canals and pipes. That takes energy. You want to treat water that's already been used once for reuse, which is becoming an increasing part of our water supply. People don't like to think about that. But sometimes the water that comes out of the cleanup situation is cleaner than the water that went in. But the idea of using somebody else's wastewater, it still bothers a lot of people. And then we have to start using desalination to a greater extent to supply fresh water, and that takes energy. And that's the major concern about desalination. It works fine, but it takes a lot of energy to clean up the salt from the water. And then, on the other side, many forms of energy production and use require water. Hydropower is an obvious one, where you run water through turbines. That requires falling water or flowing water. Thermal power plants, these are coal plants, natural gas plants, nuclear power plants. They all require cooling of their exhausts because they are Carnot engines. There's even a form of solar energy, concentrated solar energy, that operates just like a fossil fuel power plant, and you got to cool its exhaust as well because of the heat. And then the whole process of producing fossil fuels uses a lot of water. So there's a very strong linkage between water and energy in lots of ways. But there's some indirect linkages, too, that are often not talked about. I mean, certainly using energy and producing energy can contaminate water supplies. That's pretty clear. If there are competing demands for water, and you can't use your waterways as effectively as you would like because the water is being diverted, then you're going to have to ship goods some other way, and that means trucks and planes, trains, and these all take more energy. So there's that indirect linkage between waterways and use of other means of moving goods and services. The competition for water in some locations is preventing power plants from operating, particularly with nuclear, which takes a lot of water. And, of course, the most important one probably is the fact that energy produces carbon. Energy production uses carbon, puts it into the atmosphere, and creates climate change. And climate change, of course, affects the precipitation patterns which produce the water that we use. So, and that's the impact that will probably be felt in terms of climate change more earlier than almost anything else. I mean, there are obviously other effects, storms, vector migration, and other effects, but water precipitation patterns are going to change. And Sandra last night talked about some of that. All the history, I mean, the way civil engineers have designed water systems for years is to look at the last 30, 40, 50 years and say, okay, we're going to project that into the next years. That's gone. That is gone. We don't know what's coming in the next 50 years, and that's very, very important. So how do we sort of deal with this conflict? I would first point out something that I think is very fundamental to the energy field. We don't really value energy by itself. We really value what energy allows us to do. It's to sit in a warm room with lights on, move our cars, manufacture things. It's the services, the energy services that energy provides. That's really the critical thing in our society. And so what we must learn how to do is to provide those services, which is really what people want, in the most efficient way. And therefore, the wise use of energy, which some people will call energy efficiency, should be the first priority of our energy system, regardless of whether it's coming from fossil or nuclear or renewables. The other thing is to recognize that we're not in short supply on either water or energy. I've already mentioned the water numbers. There's no shortage of energy in this planet. The whole world uses about 600 quads of energy. A quad is a big unit. But you know, let's say we use about 600 quads over the whole globe. The sun pours 6 million quads of energy into our atmosphere every year. And you can calculate this very simply for yourselves if you want. I used to give it to my students as an exercise. The Earth intercepts 4 parts in 10 billion of the sun's output. 4 parts in 10 billion. And that sustains life on this planet. So there's no shortage of water. There's no shortage of energy. There's a lot of energy in hot rock under our feet due to radioactive decay in the Earth's core. That's going to keep going for quite a while, certainly until the sun swallows up this planet in about 5 billion years or so. And then there's still a lot of fossil fuel out there to be found. We're finding it all the time, especially now with the Arctic losing its ice cover. We're going to find more oil and gas up there. We're fracking oil and gas out of shale deposits. There's a lot of oil down there as well. And fossil fuels are needed because our transportation fleets depend upon it right now. And developing countries have to be provided energy while the transition is underway to a clean energy society. And then if you want to look really far into the future, and this may or may not happen, but fusion, the process that goes on in the sun, we're trying to harness it here on the Earth. I consider it the most difficult technological challenge we've ever taken on, and it's not clear if we're going to be successful. It's, you know, I like to think of it as the technology that's always 5 years away. Unfortunately, it's a very difficult problem to try to reproduce conditions on the Earth that, like those in the sun, and you can't because of the gravity of the sun, but you can substitute high temperature higher than the sun achieves for the gravity and try to achieve fusion, but we'll see if that's going to work. Some people talk about nuclear fission power, no carbon emissions. That's an important option. I'm not anti-nuclear. I just have a different preference that I would prefer. Nuclear has four problems that have to be addressed. Cost, safety, storage of the waste for very long periods of time, and then the whole question of weapons technology related to nuclear materials. On three of these, I think we can do it very well. I mean, cost, we're looking at modular reactors now. That may be a way to improve that. Safety, you can build a nuclear power plant today that does not melt down. It may cost a little bit more, but you can do it. So I don't think that a meltdown is necessary for nuclear power. Waste storage is a very hard problem, but we have to solve that because we've got the waste. We had it from the military programs during World War II, and now we have it from civilian programs. The one that scares me the most is the weapons proliferation. And I think that's going to require an international cooperative effort to take that under control. I personally would go with an increased emphasis on energy efficiency, which is very realistic. There are lots of ways to improve the efficiency by which we use energy. I would strongly move away from fossil fuels as quickly as we reasonably can. And I would really push the transition to renewable energy as quickly as we can. The question that has always been raised, certainly during my career at DOE, by the fossil fuel industry, you guys, that's cute stuff that you do, solar and wind and all that, but it can't do the job. Well, that's not true. It can do the job. Studies have documented that we could supply 80% of our electricity by the year 2050 if we really wanted to. It's going to require some investments, but the resource is there, the potential is there, and eventually we'll even get rid of the oil used in transportation for aircraft and so on for ships because we'll go to biofuels. And the Navy, U.S. Navy, is already moving rapidly in that direction. And airlines and the U.S. military, the Air Force, is testing biofuels in their aircraft. And that's coming. And the other thing you have to know is that solar and wind right now are going gangbusters. Solar and wind are the fastest growing energy sources in the world today. Now, they do start from a small base, but they are growing rapidly. And more than half of the new capacity in 2015 was renewables. You know, 10 years ago, if I had said that, you'd say I was crazy. But that's what's happening today, and it's going to speed up. Whatever I think the research community has to get active on, and these are things that are already in play, we got to reduce the water use in agriculture. Agriculture accounts for, I think, 70% of all the water use in the world. That's, you know, it's like, you remember the old story about why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is. Well, why do we go after agriculture? Because that's where the water is. So you got to do something about improving the efficiency of water use, and Jerry's talk touched on that. We have to reduce the cooling requirements of thermal power plants, and people are working on that. We have to reduce the energy requirements of desalination, because desalination is going to be an increasingly important part of our water supply. We're obviously going to reuse water. That's very important, and we have to learn how to do it as efficiently as we can. And then water decontamination. We contaminate a lot of water, either with agricultural runoff or other contaminants, and we have to learn how to clean up that water. In many places in the world, you know, in the developing world, 80% of the infections are waterborne diseases. And these people don't have many choices in many cases. And so we have to learn how to help them clean up the contaminated water supplies that they have. And there are things that you can do about that. And then there is the whole issue of water requirements of emerging energy technologies. I mentioned biofuels, takes a lot of water. Concentrating solar is a thermal process, so you need water to cool the exhaust. Carbon capture and sequestration, if it's going to work, you need a lot of water for that process. I'm not sure that carbon capture and sequestration is going to be a commercial activity. It's expensive, and it's slow. And I think by the time we develop it in a competitive way, we'll be on the renewables framework, and so it's probably not going to happen. But it's one way to use our carbon resources, like in coal and in natural gas, and we don't burn oil anymore. So that's something to keep in mind. Fracking, we have to learn how to do fracking as safely as possible. I personally am not against fracking, but I am against lack of regulation and enforcement of regulation. I think it can be done safely. The real thing that scares me are the small companies in fracking who always are looking for a shortcut and not willing to spend the money to make it safe. And then the hydrogen economy, if we ever move to a point where we use hydrogen as an energy carrier, that's going to come from water. You're going to split water, and we have to learn how to do that as efficiently as we can. And then we have to understand, you know, global climate change on a local basis and a time basis. So, you know, my general thoughts are that we're not running out of water and energy, but we will have to pay more for it as we go forward to supply both the clean water and the clean energy that we need. The two issues are inextricably linked. That's why people refer to it as the water-energy nexus. They are intimately linked. Energy security is very heavily dependent upon water availability, and water services are heavily dependent upon energy to provide those services. So what we need in this country, and perhaps in other countries as well, is a new partnership between our federal government, which really has the primary responsibility for energy in our country, and the state and local communities where water issues have historically been addressed. Thank you very much.